Want to express my appreciation. This is the last night of this gathering, and it's been a very, very pleasant month for me. And what I tend to do when things are pleasant is I cling to them. So I find myself, I was saying to a couple of people coming in the door, I find myself clinging a little bit. But that's okay, I see it. And it's an expression of a very good time and a lot of inspiration. By your teaching, by your practice and the way that you've been applying the teachings, it's been very, very good for me. And I also want to thank you also for all of your generosity. Gary was pointing to the fact that one lives on dana, and I really will do my very best to deserve what you've offered. And to spend it very wisely, I can promise you that. So thank you. Thank you again. Thank you very much for this time. It's been great. But we're not done yet. We've got the last of this series to look at tonight. And as you know, we've been looking at the Buddha's teaching on attachment, and really the teaching on attachment and non-attachment, understanding both sides of the equation, because it can be very confusing. I was talking to somebody a little earlier about how this word is used in our culture. It can connote a kind of a blasé indifference, non-attachment, and that's not at all what we're talking about here. We're talking about a capacity to see the movement of the mind to grab and to not grab what's going on, which actually leaves you with the experience itself. So far from being something that removes you from experience, is one that really puts you completely in the now, so to speak. And so it's very profound. It takes a little thinking or sorting out to realize the way that the Buddha is coming at it. So we looked at these the first three kinds of attachment in the last few weeks, starting with sense pleasures, attachment to sense pleasures, and how the mind tends to just grab hold and make of everything that comes into the field of awareness through the five physical senses and through the mind, which includes feeling, the experience of pleasure and pain, and how tangled we can get with that kind of grabbing. And we've looked at the attachment that really, in one level, manifests as a kind of compulsion in the way that we live our lives, where we just get locked into habits and patterns, ways of being, and then because of that, it's a subtle form of attachment, but it's like the mind, you've probably seen this in yourself, you just kind of glom onto your way of doing things and never really experience what we're doing. You know, you can go through the whole morning routine, for example, and not have been in any of it. You know, you ever watch yourself sometimes eat a meal, you know, and all of a sudden the plate's empty. Well, what happened? You know, where'd it go? You know, not even like you would plan and wait all day for these delicious meals, and then you have one, you don't even notice what happened. You know, and this is an attachment to what the Buddha called rites and rituals, precepts and practices. But it also manifests as an attachment to, say, ideas about things like generosity and morality and even the meditation, such that we try to live our ideas about it and never really go where the practices are designed to take us, because we're kind of clinging to a very superficial, kind of notional way of being with methods and techniques and things like this. And so you can get, I mean, it's quite possible to get really good at watching the breath, which is like, you know, why would you want to do that? But you can. And that's an attachment to meditation, you know, to the forms of meditation. And this, like I was trying to describe in our just our little guide here, that what it's about is relaxing, knowing what's happening. We use the breath as an object to help, just to focus. It's it's I think it gets picked up sometimes too much as why we're doing it, is to watch the breath. But really, it's about relaxing and paying attention. And when you're sitting here with your eyes closed in a half-dark room, there's not a whole lot happening. or, you know, what is happening is you're breathing. And so it's more like that. That's why the Buddha suggests the breath. It's a dominant feature of our knowing when we're still. Yeah? So come at it that way instead of trying to get good at watching the breath. And then last week we looked at attachment to views and ideas and opinions and, you know, just seeing very clearly that it's not the view that's the issue. It's the attachment to it. And so clearly all of us have our own ideas about the way things are, the way it is in our lives. And the idea is that we as Buddhist practitioners work to develop mutual respect, you know, that people have different ideas about things, different political views, different views about the way things are at a social and political level, and we need to respect that. But if we dig our heels in, demand that people see things our way, that our way is the right way, then this is the stuff that wars are made of, out of, you know. So you have nothing but battles and contention and difficulties in life. So, I mean, this is all, you know, it's not a very mystifying teaching at all when you look at what he's saying in these things. And this last one, attachment to the sense of self, this is actually, in some lists, there's only the three, that because attachment to self is also considered a view. Attachment to self-view, to the view of me as the one to whom things are happening, or who's sort of the owner of this body and mind, who occupies and makes it function, you know. And this is kind of like a weird teaching, for the Buddha's teaching on non-self. But I hope to kind of unpack this a little bit in a way tonight that makes it not seem so weird, because at first glance it sounds very strange. But the first time that we hear about it, it's interesting that after the Buddha's enlightenment, when he sought out the five ascetics to give them a teaching, he taught the teaching on the Four Noble Truths. This is the widely viewed to be the first and one of the most significant teachings in the Buddhist teachings. And in that first noble truth is where we first hear about this teaching of non-self, although he doesn't quite put it this way, but he gives a litany of the things that constitute suffering. And this is the key recognition. The first noble truth is there is difficulty, and these are the things that constitute our difficulty. Upadana, attachment, is named in here. It's a biggie. And, you know, it goes sickness, aging, and death, having to associate with things we don't like, being separated from things we like, not getting what we want. And then there's this little tag, sort of, where he says, in brief or in summary, what constitutes suffering is the five focuses of the grasping mind. He says the five focuses of the grasping mind are suffering, or sometimes it's translated as the five focuses of identity. The five things that we cling to as being who we are. That's what that means. Five focuses of identity are suffering. And he doesn't name them here, but he does. But these are the body. It's really just the body and mind. The body and the mind. We focus on these and think this is who we are, but it's not the case. So there's the body, there's feelings, there's perceptions, which includes a number of things I'll mention. There's our habits and patterns, what they call karma formations, and then there's even consciousness itself. So it's widely viewed that, you know, he just left it at that for a little while, mentioning it, and then he didn't give another talk for like 4 or 5 days. a lot of people imagine or surmise, you know, just kind of speculate, really, you know, what went on in those 5 days? What was he talking about, you know? And you can speculate that he was kind of putting a little flesh on the bone of that first teaching, the Four Noble Truths, and that he probably got into a little bit about this teaching on the five aggregates. But the second teaching, the second formal teaching, was called the Anattalakkhana Sutta. And this is where he spells out that it's an attachment to body, feelings, perceptions, our karma, our patterns and habits of mind and body, and consciousness that constitutes our suffering. And he says it in that sutta, and there's quite a number of suttas in the Pali Canon where he mentions that. One of my favorites is the Greater Discourse on the Full Moon Night, if you ever want to look it up. In that sutta, he says, in no uncertain terms, he said, do not regard these five things as self. That's the language. Do not regard body, feelings, perception, formations, and consciousness as self. I don't know about you, but the first time I heard that, I went, what? You know, it was like, you know, this is me. I am my ideas. I am my feelings. I am my likes and dislikes. I am this body. You know, this knowing, what am I if not this bit that is aware of what's going on, you know? But I think it's really interesting because, I mean, I know some of you are here from a world religions class, and you can probably attest to this as well. I think that really, virtually all, if not most, of the world religions say that we are not this body and mind. And so Buddhism is not alone in this, you know. But perhaps where Buddhism stands apart is that a lot of the rest of the 45 years that the Buddha taught, he's explaining how this is true and teaching us how to see that it's true as well, you know, because it's Buddhism and liberation is anything, it's accessible, you know, and so he kind of walks through in many of the suttas how to see this for ourselves. So that's what I thought we could do tonight, is just to get a sense of what he's saying here, because as I said, it can seem a little weird at first, but not so weird when you understand and observe. See for yourself through your own practice what he's getting at. So the body. So we pick up the meditation, we practice for a while. And after a while, you begin to get some sense of non-attachment to the body. You know, one begins to see over the months and years of practice that what's going on at a sensory level is sort of operating according to its own laws. There's not a whole lot to do. You can influence it, but you can't control it. You can't. Maybe we can manage it a little bit, but that's about the best that we can do. And so, one way that we see this, and the way the Buddha points to it in the teaching on meditation, is he says to be aware of the body as it moves about. So that, you know, this teaching on the mindfulness in the four postures. And this is really one of the best ways to see it as well. That, you know, just look, just watch during the course of a day or week or month, however, the rest of your life if you want, how this body is moving about. It's fascinating. Because, you know, you sit in here, you might be sitting here and think, well, after this talk is over, I'm going to get up and I'm going to go to the car and I'm going to drive down the road and I'm going to go do this and do that and blah, 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 blah. So we have all these ideas that there's some agency in here. You know, you feel like you, because you have the idea of moving this body, that's how it happens. But watch and see if that's true. You know, it's moving all the time. And there's not like this connect between me and making that happen. it's moving according to, in a way, according to its own laws, you know. And you stand back and you watch, and over the months and years of practice, you begin to collect data. And the data do not substantiate the idea that this is me and I'm the one directing the show. And that's not to be believed. That's just to be seen and look at for ourselves. You know, or another way to look at it is like we take care of the body, do everything that we can to make it healthy. You eat right. You know, you eat your sprouts, you grow your vegetables and make sure you eat or buy organic vegetables and all like this, and which is all very, very good. But you still get sick. You know, we still get sick. And, you know, we can do everything that we can to prevent that from happening. But it still happens, doesn't it? And, you know, there's nothing to be done about that. There's so many factors that go into what happens to the body. And if we don't know this, and here's where the attachment is, if we don't get this or consider it, then you can go crazy. People go nuts. You know, what's the matter? I ate my sprouts. I did everything I was supposed to do. Why am I sick? I mean, I've said that. Have you said that? What's the matter with me? Why am I sick? You know, it's compounding what's already a difficult situation. You know, you're sick. So the teaching here, the non-attachment, when that gets engaged, then what gets played out is one becomes a great steward for the body, because you don't argue with the condition that it's in at any given time. You just deal with it. You just address it, because the mind has gotten it that it's operating according to its own laws, or that there's many, many factors, you know. And we can do everything that we can to stay healthy, and then you have an accident or something happens, and you know, can get very ill very quickly. So it's this kind of thing. Or just, I mean, one of the biggies for a lot of us, some of you are quite young here and may not be on the front burner yet, but a big one for a lot of us is aging, you know. And, you know, come on. I was telling somebody, we were talking about some of the issues, the political issues in life, and I said, man, I got my hands full with sickness, aging, and death, you know. I don't think I have any more energy for all this other stuff, you know. But it's true. I mean, just, you know, especially in your 50s and into the 60s, where we can pretend it's not happening for a long time. You know, and then all of a sudden it is so in your face, literally. You know, everything just starts to fall. Everything goes south. You know, gravity just does its thing. You know, I remember Maya Angelou was saying one time she thought her boobs were in a race for the floor. It's just sagging, sagging, sagging. Or else it just goes out, east and west. You know? Everything just changes. It fills out and drops down. And there's nothing to be done about it. But if we're attached to it, if we're really attached to it, and people are, most of us, I mean, come on, let's be honest. It can be a difficult 10 years or so, where one is really trying to adjust to the reality of this fact, you know. And sure, if this body was mine and I could I could control it. You think I'd age? You know, it's like you would do something about all that. I mean, we can try, and I've been fascinated. I was telling one of the monks how fascinating it is to go into the pharmacies these days, and CVS and Walgreens and all, how the shelves of skincare products, as the baby boomers reach 50 and 60, you know, and more, is just huge. It's overflowing, and all with these little tags, you know, which got me. They get me sometimes, you know, that age-defying, anti-aging, you know, it's got like reverses aging, that kind of stuff, you know. And I mean, the manufacturers are not stupid, you know. They know how to get us to buy it, and it's kind of capitalizing on our delusion, you know, which is sad when you think about it. You're kind of being taken advantage of, or, you know, mistreated in a way. So no matter what we do, the skin still sags, and the age spots appear, and the wrinkles appear, and all of that. So, you know, you come to the conclusion at some point, well, if you can muster some semblance of impartiality towards it all, and see how we can't do much about all of that, then you come to some conclusion like, well, maybe it's not who I am. In a way, it's kind of like, I hope it's not who I am. Oh, thank goodness it's not who I am, or whatever. But the non-attachment to the body as self makes it possible to see things as they are. This is the way it is. This is the way the body is. But it's not who we are. And so one can learn to relate, you know, as the Buddha said, do not regard it as self. Just contemplate that. Do not regard this as self. Consider the gift that he's giving us in that. Yeah. If I can learn to relate that way, wow, where's the suffering? Where's the suffering? It's not there. Other than the basic existential fact of the pains and things like that that go on with the body. But the compounded suffering is eliminated. Now, I love that. I mean, it's not a weird teaching. It's a gift he's giving us to help us to suffer less. Upadana is suffering. So now we watch feeling, the second one. We watch over the months and years of our lives and, you know, begin to get a sense that this too need not be regarded as self. This is not self as well. And really, one of the things that one begins to see as a Buddhist practitioner quite early on, really, is that how much of our time is spent in this endless quest to experience pleasant feeling and to avoid unpleasant feeling. You know, and so you get this longing for a certain thing, a feeling, and resistance to others. And over time, it doesn't take much watching or looking to see how exhausting that is. It's like we're trying to get comfortable once and for all, you know? They would do that laying in bed, you know, just slather. You know, it can be irritating that it doesn't stay comfortable long, very long, you know. We struggle to make it that way. So, but then as the years go by, as we practice with this, then we begin to see for ourselves how exhausting that is. You know, we're wearing ourselves out with this endless quest for pleasure and for the avoidance of pain. I think it's actually a big player in bringing us to an early grave, even. You know, it's hard on the system. It's very hard on the system. So then what you begin to see over time is that pleasure and pain happen. they happen. There's not much to be done about it. I mean, we can go to great extremes to try to set it up so that there's a lot of pleasure and it may not happen. We can go to great extremes to avoid pain and it still happens. You know, I'm sure you've seen this, but it's like it doesn't register. It doesn't get in there deep enough. This is, I think, what the Buddha is pointing to, just to help us to see that sometimes you feel good and sometimes you feel bad. And that's the way it goes. I don't know how this happens, particularly, but it does. I can't explain it. The Buddha says it's karma. It's the fruits of past actions. But the point is that it's not linked with me. It's that this is the way pleasure and pain operate. They arise out of conditions, and there's really nothing to be done about it. And so we might as well let it go. And I think this is what he's pointing to. Just imagine life having totally relinquished this endless quest. It feels like having a great burp or something, you know. You mean I can let it all go? Yeah. But guess what? There'll still be a lot of pleasure. In fact, we'll feel it even more. And we'll still experience pain, but because we're not pissed off about it or fighting it or resisting it, then it just moves through more quickly. You know, it's like a wave. Every arisen phenomenon has about 3 seconds of fame, you know, if we don't grab it or obstruct it. It just moves through, you know. And I like that, you know. And besides, what you begin to see is that happiness doesn't depend on one or the on the getting of one and the avoiding of the other. It absolutely doesn't depend on that. And just look and see. You know, we can be very happy in the presence of great difficulty, and we can be miserable in the presence of great pleasure. They aren't linked necessarily. So what he's pointing to here is getting a sense that feelings are not self. Do not regard feelings as self. Just let them happen and be aware of them, of the arising pain. And this is a very critical part of practice, because feeling, the experience of pleasure and pain, is a key player in the process of waking up. And it's almost like that capacity has to be, we have to learn to let that happen in an unobstructed way, so that we can know things that are harmful and things that are not. It's almost like this is the main mechanism that we have as human beings that hardwires us for freedom. You know, if we can work with it in an unobstructed and not self-oriented way. The trouble is, we make it the mechanism for self-gratification instead of just more neutrally, more impartially. This is what happens. Feeling happens. So now perception's tricky, and we could do a whole session sometime, a whole 4 weeks on perception alone. This is a very meaty area of the Buddhist teachings. So I can't go into all the different ways that we cling to perception, but just to say that it includes, perception includes things like language, the names that we give to things, so that the mind is always trying to sort out and get a fix on the objects that we're seeing, you know, but includes more complex activities of mind or functions of mind, like associating, you know, like the how the mind. Do you ever have a conversation with somebody and they're telling you about something that happened to them, and in your mind you're associating, relating to that activity? And, you know, sometimes I felt that so strongly in my own mind. It's like you can't wait for them to shut up so you can tell them what happened to you, you know? It's that kind of activity of mind where it's just always relating and associating. It's actually identification with that, getting caught up in it. It's a very painful habit. You know, you're never here. You're just always relating to what's being said and what's happening. And it's very, very difficult. But now it also includes memory and plans, so that some of the, one of the functions of the mind is the weirdest thing. I mean, it remembers things. You know, you have to stop and think about that. I mean, it just, you're sitting here minding your own business and you smell honeysuckle, and all of a sudden you think of Aunt Tilly, you know, because that was her perfume or something, you know. Wild stuff, you know, but it's how it's happening. Or you see something, or there's a signpost or a billboard or something, and or somebody says something, and we start to make a plan. you know, start to think about how we're going to do that or what's next for us, that kind of thing. So identification with these two in particular create a lot of suffering. Because the mind is deceived momentarily into, you know, it's very hard when memories come up not to breathe them back into life. It's very hard when ideas come up about tomorrow to not think, start leaning, you know. It's like we're already in tomorrow and it's not even here. So this is the way that the attachment to these two functions of mind create suffering. For us. So the idea here is, you know, over the months and years of practice, you begin to see how doing that is the very thing that's creating a sense of yesterday and tomorrow, creating a sense of having a past and a future. And the attachment to those two is what's keeping us out of the present moment. You know, it's incessant. When you start to see this stuff, you know, it's like, boy, no wonder we're never here. We're always thinking about what happened or worrying about what might happen, you know, and imagining a tomorrow that is either wonderful or awful, and then we set up housekeeping in these thoughts and live there, you know, for a lot of the time. So it's very, very, very painful stuff. It gives us a very visceral sense of a past and a future. And yet, what escapes us in that, in moments where this kind of attachment is strong, is the reality of now, the present moment. Man, when I know when I was watching this one time in my own practice on a formal retreat, it was so painful. It was like, I just want to be here. I just want to be here. And yet, you know, I saw it one time as like that image of trying to find the mate to your socks in the drawer, you know. It's in here somewhere, you know, that kind of feeling and that frantic sense of now. It escapes us almost entirely. So this kind of attachment to perception is what affects essentially a bias in the mind against now, and a very, very painful experience. But as you see it, as we see it, and that's all that we don't have to make ourselves stop doing this, just the experience of seeing what it feels like to do it, then the mind begins to relinquish the grip that it has on the past and the future. It begins to settle more. But you find that, especially those of you who have been at it for a long time, it just begins to settle more in the present, and the sense of the past and the future lose their apparent reality. Because really, I mean, on one level, sure, on a conventional level, that did happen to me. Maybe this, yeah, I do have that appointment. You know what I mean? So you have on one level, you do have this sense of past and future, but in the purest sense, even those are just thoughts in the present moment about something. And this holds tremendous promise for this kind of learning, this kind of non-attachment, for especially if your particular past happens to be a very painful one. How are you going to relinquish that? How are you going to release from that kind of thing when these things keep coming up and we just keep breathing them back into life and reliving them? I mean, who hasn't had the experience of trying, of rehashing and trying to recreate things that happened 20, 30, 40 years ago for some of us, you know? So the impartiality that non-attachment to perception creates is the capacity to see a memory as a memory, to see a plan as a plan, an idea, a fantasy, and not get lost in it. So the Buddha is saying, don't regard memories and ideas and fantasies as self. It sounds crazy, but boy, do I get it now. You know what I mean? It's like, just relate differently to it. Don't keep buying into it as who we are. I love that. I mean, you know, that one in particular. If you want to pick up a great practice, look at Sanya, the perception khanda, for a while. This is the same thing that rules all the perceptions and views we have about the world, whether it's safe, whether it's an okay place to be, about ideas we have about each other. I mean, I was watching this one time with just different people I've known in my life, and how I wondered if I knew them at all. You know, that they're, it's all my ideas about who they are that I'm relating to. Yeah. Very, potentially very liberating stuff. Okay? So now the karma formations. The sankhara is the fourth one. This is kind of interesting. It has different translations. Karma formations, mental formations. It's sort of the things that form in the mind. As you know, that's where that word formations is coming from. So like somebody barks at you, and you feel aversion. You know, aversion is a formation. It forms in the mind in relation to something that happened. Yeah, that kind of thing. And we call them karma formations too, because they're habits. Karma is habit, patterns of mind. You know, all of us have our own little brand, our own collection of these. You know, your habits might be different than mine, but we each have some pretty strong habits. And the idea here this practice is beginning to see what these are. So, you know, for example, like some of the, I understand you had a talk not long ago, sometime this year, about the three types of greed, hatred, and delusion, you know, the three kinds of personalities that are spoken of in the commentaries. So that, you know, you begin to notice that maybe your mind tends towards aversion, you know, where things, you know, you start to, you see the world as things to get rid of, you know. If I could just get away from this or get out of this situation or something like that, then everything would be all right. Or the greedy mind sees all the things as objects to acquire, not just physical objects, but even ideas and patterns of mind. So that, you know, that's how we relate, you know. What can I get to make me happy? What can I do to make me happy? How can I make you make me happy? You know, that kind of stuff. Or the deluded type is kind of out to lunch all the time, you know, just not connecting. Vaguely, I always think of the word vague as a great word to describe deluded people. Sort of vaguely here, you know, that kind of thing, where not really knowing what's happening and not particularly wanting to, you know, just kind of a little bit detached in this way, but not in a wise way, detached in a deluded way. So whatever the tendency that we have, and, you know, these, we all have all of these, but some are more dominant than others. The point is, as practitioners, we begin to see them, don't you? And even, hopefully, if you've got a good sense of humor, to be able to relax about it and laugh about it a little bit, see how quickly the mind will go into these ways of relating to what's going on. And what you begin to notice over time, this is the stuff that gets real personal. You know, especially if my habits aren't particularly skillful, then if I'm relating to that with, and deriving an identity around that, if I'm relating to it with any kind of clinging, then I become a bad person. Yeah? Very quickly, in a finger snap. And what the Buddha's pointing to here is tremendously liberating. He's basically saying is to don't regard your habits, your patterns, your addictions. Don't regard any of that as who you are. It gets a little tricky, because it's like, well, wait a minute, you know, I'm the one doing it, she's not, you know, it's here. But it's a subtle thing that he's pointing to here. Don't grab it in a way so as to feed it or hate it. That's the impartiality. That's the non-clinging. But rather, see it. By all means, see it and feel it, especially if it's an unskillful habit. You're suffering. You know, so feel it. Let the whole body and mind know what it feels like to be at the mercy of this kind of pattern. Yeah? And feel it and trust that that's the process. That is what's going to change it over time. No amount of smacking ourselves around, feeling ashamed, or trying to make ourselves be some other way is going to do it. That it's not that that's not a player. It can be a player, especially with some habits. But ultimately, the way that we change our habits is by feeling them and knowing from within them what's skillful and what's not. Yeah. This is very liberating stuff. So that if you get what's being said here, then I don't care what you're doing. Learn to see it impartially and feel it, and let that experience do its magic. That over time begins to shift us. You know, if it was who you are, you could control it better. You know what I mean? If you ever get stuck in some addictive pattern, I used to do this with smoking, you know, and it was like, you know, I just so did not want to smoke. I so did not want to smoke. And then I'd be like, no. Let it go, no. The whole, I mean, even while I'm doing it, you know, the fighting, the resisting, yeah. The people who have worked with some of these habits sort of meditatively, they just, you know, dare to be the way that you are and to be there for it. You know, and granted, if it's a really bad thing and you're doing harm to other people, that's different. But if it's some of our ordinary, everyday habits that are less than skillful, then understand that when the Buddha says that it's unskillful or unwholesome, all he's saying is you're suffering with it. And you find a way to stop suffering with it. Feel it. So I was recounting the other day in our little workshop that just one of the ways you can see this is just noticing in any moment where you're conflicted internally. If you ever had that thought, I don't know what's going on with me. Part of me feels this way, and part of me feels that way. You know, that kind of thing. What's that? If you're in control here, which one is you? You know what I mean? It's just all arising conditions and phenomenon, and it just needs to be seen. So we often have to go through a very painful process before we begin to see all of this. But what the Buddha is saying is don't regard the states that arise in your mind as self. They're arising out of conditions. And our job is to see them, relax in the presence of them, relate to them impartially, and discover from within that what serves us and what doesn't. That's all. It's a very loving practice. It's a very directly experiential practice. Now consciousness gets a little tricky. To see this as not self, you know, because there's something in here that's connecting with the things I'm seeing. You know, my eyes are looking at objects and something in my experience is seeing. Yeah, that sure feels like me. That sure feels like me. But even this, the Buddha is saying, don't regard this as self. And I don't know, if you're like me, certainly in the early years of practice, just when you begin to notice this bit that's making the connections. Now it's seeing, now it's hearing, now it's smelling, now it's tasting, now it's touching, now it's thinking, now it's feeling, now it's seeing. Now it's, yeah? It's just this constant stream of conscious awareness connected with the five physical senses and the mind. Yeah? And going on one second after another, from the time you're born till you die. That's what it is. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting. That's it. You know. Actually, that alone is an interesting reflection. That's all it is. That is all that's going on here. You know. And if you're experiencing anything else, you're probably not from this planet. Probably not a human being as we know it. So, you know, but in the early years of practice, I thought that what we were supposed to do was trying to quiet that and try to control that. But it takes a little time to get it. That there's actually, you watch and you look, there's something that knows even that. There's a knowing of that. And so we have to be able to relax in the presence of this constant flitting of consciousness. Yeah. And then as you manage that, then you actually find you get a little more relaxed and centered. So, you know, a good tip to the early meditators, if this is what you're doing, just know that. Don't worry about it. It just keeps changing. That's actually what the Buddha is saying. Six kinds of consciousness, constantly changing, related to the six senses. Now, in intensive practice, you can actually see consciousness. What you do, you know, if you've ever had the experience, for example, of just isolating out a sensation. Do you ever notice where sometimes you can just say, go to a pain in your knee, and that's all you know. The mind is so focused on that, on sensation. That sensation is all you know. And everything else drops away. Well, it's possible to do that with consciousness itself. And I realize this might be a little elusive if you haven't done this kind of intensive practice. But the mind can get so still that it actually, the totality of your experience becomes not the object that you're seeing, not the eye that's seeing it, but the direct experience of seeing. And when that happens, for example, then everything else falls away. So you have a sense, just for a flicker, of there's no object, there's no eye. All that exists in that moment is seeing, the experience of seeing. And it's kind of like one of those kind of moments, you know. it can feel like you're having some kind of no self experience, because like Bucky Fuller said when he saw this, he said, I seem to be a verb. You know, because we think of ourselves as nouns. Me, I'm a being, a being, and a momentary experience or direct experience of consciousness allows the to drop away. Mm-hmm. You know, there's just being. There's just the direct experience of being, or seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. But the interesting thing, and this can trip meditators up a lot because it feels very far out, you know. But the interesting thing that one needs to see here, if you stay with it, you can actually see one of the key players in the formation of self-view. Because what happens with a moment like that is this mind associates. The sanyakanda comes in and it goes, oh, I see. It puts this little tag on it. It's like this pure experience of consciousness becomes something that now I am doing. I own it. I am the one who is doing it. And yet it can be observed very directly that is not what's happening. What the Buddha is saying, essentially, is that that's a distortion. There isn't any I see. That's something that the mind is, it's in a feedback loop. It's telling itself what it's seeing, what's happening. And it's doing that in a way that makes it me. Can you feel that? It's like, I see. And yet, that has to be seen, or can be seen, to be relinquished. Because that is just not it. We are verbs. We are processes. We're not objects. We're not things. We're processes. And the direct observation of consciousness is one of the best ways to see that. And or even just considering it intellectually. If you don't practice in this way, or see it in this way directly, just give that some thought. This is pretty far out stuff what he's saying here. That lose the ownership of this process of life and let it be what it is. This is essentially what he's pointing to. So it's easy. Just don't regard all this as self. So it's not so easy, is it? But it can be. But part of the dilemma is in the very word that he's pointing to, in the very word that he uses to describe these aggregates, these five aggregates. That's the English, but the Pali word is khanda, and it has a number of different translations. So that it means, in some circles, it's translated as a web, a tangled web. I mean, it refers to a groups of things. It's a group or a collection or a constellation. So it's, he's saying the body has a lot of different things going on with it. Feeling has a lot of different things. So in that sense, it's a group. But it's also often referred to as referring to the fact that this is all a muddle. This is all very tangled and confused in the mind, that it doesn't discern discreetly physical things from emotional things from mental things. They all get compacted into a single event, like if you have a sensation that you're finding painful and go right into hating it. I don't know about you, but in my own practice, it was very hard for me for a long time to separate those out. It was like, as soon as something happens, this is awful, this is horrible. And that's my world. But what the Buddha is pointing to through the foundations of mindfulness, the main practice that we have for meditation, is separate these out. Leave the body, let the body be the body. Let feelings be feelings. Let the mind be the mind. And that's the beginning of a process that, if you can manage that, that alone is a huge relief, because we've untangled the web. You begin to break the whole experience apart, and so that the attachment to that movement of the mind will begin to diminish and ultimately be uprooted, because we're learning to let it be what it is. And then we can see things from that position. We're able to see the process that we are a lot more clearly, because the discrete aspects of it have been sorted out. So, this is the way it is what the Buddha's pointing to. Just, don't believe it. Look and see through your own observation to see if what he's saying here is true, I can't explain it. Things happen. The body behaves this way. Feelings behave this way. The mind behaves this way. And our job, as people who are interested in waking up, is to see it. To see it and discern for ourselves, discover for ourselves that this thing that he's describing here is true. And that indeed, understanding it and relating to it in the way that he's describing constitutes our freedom. It's all right there. And in one sense, it's very, very simple. Ajahn Chah said one time, very oft quoted remark, which I'll just abbreviate, but he put it this way. He said, try to be mindful and let things take their natural course. Then your mind will become like a still forest pool. Many wild and wonderful animals will come and drink at the pool. It's symbolic of all the things that happen. But you will be still. Yeah? And then he says, this is the happiness of the Buddha. This is the happiness of a mind that's been liberated. Yeah? So good luck with it. I hope you have fun with it, because it's such an interesting process and practice. So I offer you this for your reflection tonight. Again, thank you very much. It's been a wonderful stay. And I've gone right up to the time that it's time to go. So if anybody has any questions, I'll hang around as long as it takes. Okay? Do take care.